Welcome back. You're listening to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Are you worried about Iran? Should you be? Earlier this week, I spoke to Michael Rubin from the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He has a PhD in history from Yale. He's lectured at Yale University, Hebrew University. He's worked as visiting lecturer at universities in the Middle East. And between 2002 and 2004, he worked as a country director for Iran and Iraq in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. As you might imagine, about someone who works in a Washington think tank, he has a different perspective on the Middle East from Robert Fisk, who is also here this week. He was the lead drafter of a bipartisan report on Iranian nuclear development, which Barack Obama and John McCain are being briefed on this week. I asked him to give us an idea what's in it.
The briefing document's called the Task Force on U.S. Policy Towards Iranian Nuclear Development. It was sponsored by an outfit in Washington called the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is run by the last four leaders of the U.S. Senate, two Democrats and two Republicans. The task force itself was chaired by two retired senators, a Republican, Senator Daniel Coats, and a Democrat, Senator Chuck Robb. What we did was gather the major advisors to Senators Clinton, Senator Obama, and Senator McCain, of which I'm a McCain advisor, and tried to find, when it came to Iran, what facts did we agree on, what policies did we agree on, and even where we disagreed, what were the different lines of thought into the disagreement to create a document that looks at the complexities of how the United States and the West should deal with the challenge coming from Iran.
And what is the challenge that essentially that you see coming from Iran?
The consensus of the group was that a nuclear-capable Iran, an Iran that was capable of developing nuclear weapons, would be strategically untenable. It would be strategically untenable for several reasons. First of all, it would create a wave of proliferation. Already, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, and even Yemen have talked about their desire to construct a nuclear capability. I sat in a meeting with Gamal Mubarak, the son of the Egyptian president, who basically, with a nod and a wink, said, yes, our program will be civilian in nature, sort of like Iran's is civilian in nature, which creates a threat. Number two, while there was consensus that if there's a breakout capability where Iran develops nuclear weapons, that we don't think the most likely scenario is that they would use those nuclear weapons, there was a fear that the overconfidence which Iran would develop because they felt that they were immune behind a nuclear shield may lead to another wave of terrorism, much like we saw in the 1980s. Already the Iranians have made statements with regard to not recognizing the sovereignty of Bahrain, for example, or discussing whether or not the Persian Gulf should be as open to international shipping as it is now. In general, with the Middle East as unstable as the Middle East is, we did not think that a nuclear-armed Iran would lead to stability. We also dismissed the notion that deterrence, much like occurred during the Cold War, is a model that should be pursued, because in retrospect, many people forget just how many close calls there were between the United States and the Soviet Union and so forth. At the very least, that's a situation that should be avoided. And then we talked about all the different diplomatic, economic, and indeed military strategies which need to be implemented now. And I do want to emphasize, when I talk about military strategies, I don't mean to say bombing or invasion or anything like that. There's defensive military strategies, for example, containment, if Iran becomes nuclear, is itself a military strategy that requires protecting the other Persian Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and so forth, Azerbaijan, ensuring the passage of oil, for example, by ensuring that there's enough minesweepers in the region and assets to protect those minesweepers and so forth. What we're trying to do is add complexity to the debate so that some of these terms and some of the Iran debate, which is being discussed in Europe and the United States right now, would be discussed at a if you will, a policy practitioner level rather than just bantered around as empty rhetoric.
I think what might make people a little apprehensive here is the notion that a country might be being demonized in the way that Iraq was, and that you ended up with a proposition about weapons of mass destruction that appeared in hindsight to be crying wolf. Can you reassure people about that?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the notion of intelligence took a huge hit after Iraq, where not only the United States intelligence proved wrong, the French, the Germans, the Russians, and so forth, the other intelligence proved wrong as well. The difference with Iran is that all the intelligence that's being generated is being generated through International Atomic Energy Agency inspections. And since Iran's covert enrichment facility was discovered and inspected, I believe discovered in 2002, inspected in 2003, there's been a series of reports and a series of unanswered questions which the Iranians have been challenged to come clean on. For example, why did the International Atomic Energy Agency detect traces of uranium metal, which has a role in weapons construction but doesn't have a role in a nuclear energy cycle? Likewise, there are some issues of plutonium contamination and so forth. So what we're looking at that, but this actually raises an issue. The report certainly did not come out recommending military action, but it also came out recognizing problems with diplomacy. One of the issues we did, we hired physicists to look at what we know about the Iranian nuclear enrichment situation based on international inspections. And they number crunched, and they talked about different variables, the number of centrifuges, the number, the cascades of the centrifuges, the enrichment level of the feedstock, which is put into every level of the centrifuges. And what they determined is under certain situations, Iran could produce 20 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, enough for a crude bomb, within 17 days. This doesn't mean that suddenly there should be military strikes. What this means is that how are we going to design inspections so that inspections occur more frequently than once every 17 days? So what we're trying to do is combine the science and the engineering with the inspection regime to create a great deal of confidence, because it's the uncertainty which is driving the crisis. The more transparency there is, the better, and this will also avoid a fiasco like Iraq.
That you'd probably be aware, Robert Fisk has been here the same week that you're visiting. One argument he makes consistently is that he believes that the West has been involved in the Middle East for the best part of a century and always disastrously, and that, to paraphrase him wildly, the best thing you could do is take the West out of the Middle East. I doubt that you would concur with that.
I doubt I would concur with that too. First of all, I mean, the West has had a troubled history in the Middle East, and frankly the Middle East has had a troubled history in the West to some extent as well. The interaction of the West and the Middle East hasn't been all negative. There has been negatives and there has been positives. That's the nature of international relations. What one would certainly say is, while Iran talks about how there shouldn't be any foreign presence in the Persian Gulf, you certainly wouldn't get consensus on that from the peoples of Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. So there is a balance, and I think, frankly, Mr. Fisk is being a little bit simplistic in this regard, and perhaps reflecting a political agenda rather than the whole wide range of popular opinion on the ground in the Middle East. And certainly the Middle East is not a homogenous place. There is a huge range of opinion there.
I know that you worked under Paul Bremer in the early days of the Provisional Authority in Iraq. You're quite critical of the way he acquitted himself there. Would that be right?
That would be right. I mean, I've been quite open about that from the time I was very early on in the Coalition Provisional Authority. I recognized the bubble which the Americans and others were living in, and so I moved into the red zone, into Baghdad proper, to live and work among ordinary Iraqis, doing my job by email and trying to create a reality check on some of the debates which were going on inside the green zone.
That's bold, living outside the green zone. Did you feel that your life was in danger?
No, I didn't. Before the war, actually, I worked in the Iraqi Kurdish University system, ironically teaching Iranian history, which was part of their curriculum. Therefore, I had a whole range of students who, and their extended families who I could trust so long as I hadn't given them below a B. And also because I had done my PhD in Iranian history and had studied in Iran as well and had interacted with many different Shia, I had a whole wide range, perhaps a much broader range of deep personal contacts with whole different communities inside Iraq than did most of the American diplomats or other experts who were just coming for a six-month deployment. So as anyone who's been in the Middle East knows, there's a great deal of hospitality, a great deal of warmness, and what matters isn't necessarily the position you are in, but the personal relationships which you had developed. And when the crisis erupted in 2003, I had already had personal relationships with so many different Iraqis going back years and years, so I felt perfectly safe.
So I presume you would endorse the approach, though, for Petraeus, which has been to engage to a much larger extent with the populace. Would that be true?
Well, one of my other jobs is working with the Naval Postgraduate School, training all U.S. officers who are deploying to Afghanistan and Iraq. And one of the analogies which really strikes me to illustrate, in this case, the wisdom of General Petraeus, is that when you have a patrol, and it doesn't matter who's in the patrol, it could be the New Zealand PRT, for example, in Afghanistan, and if they are shot at from a village on the side of the road, it's very rare that an insurgent is going to fire a gun or detonate a bomb from the living room of his own house. So before you take a high caliber machine gun and fire back, you need to think about who's in that living room, who's in the house behind him and the house behind him, because sometimes it's wise not to just go in with overwhelming power, but to be a little bit smarter about it. And I think this is where General Petraeus has had a great deal of success.
Can I ask you just finally then, are you optimistic about the prospects for that region?
I don't think anyone in their right mind would ever be optimistic about the prospects for the Middle East. The important thing is to basically ensure a great deal of stability and security while at the same time ensuring the development of civil society. This is actually one of those issues which New Zealand can play a huge role in when it comes to small state diplomacy and so forth. One of the most interesting trends in Iran today has to do with the development of independent trade unions for the first time, because up until a couple years ago, the Islamic Republic itself controlled all unions. Now, in December 2005, you had basically a Gdansk moment, referring to solidarity in Poland, when the bus drivers created, through a huge struggle, an independent trade union. You had a replication of this among some of the sugarcane workers down in Khuzestan, which is along the border of Iraq this year. What I would strongly argue is in any country where the government is forced to be more responsive to the people rather than being adventurous and pumping money into nuclear programs, missile programs, and so forth, that's only for the best. And this is where I'd actually agree with Robert Fisk. There's no doubt that the Americans, before the Americans, the British and the Russians, the French, have a history that's not always positive in the region. This is where there's room for neutral countries and smaller countries that may not have that legacy to get involved. And knowing Iran and having lived there, there's a great deal of thirst for others to get involved and help civil society.
That was Michael Rubin from the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research talking about nuclear development in Iran and whether there is a future for the Middle East. Coming up after the break, something a little more cheerful. We're going to the theatre talking to the writer of the new play, Grace.